This cassette tape regarding Avraham Avinu is dedicated in memory of George Ginsberg, who died on the 15th of Kislev, Tovshin Mem Gimel. It is dedicated by Marty and Carol Ginsberg, his children and their family.
Tonight's lecture is about Avraham Avinu. There are singular personalities in the history of the world who, because of their actions and behavior, change the course of civilization, change the course of the world generally. And the primary example of such a person in human civilization is our father Abraham. The one person who, more than anyone else, changed forever the course of mankind, the way man would think about himself and his relationship to life generally and to the Creator particularly. And therefore, Avraham is called Av Hamon Goyim, the father of many nations, of a multitude of nations, because he's the father really of all civilization. From the time of Avraham onwards, people would never think about themselves the same way. And that enormous change in thought and in perception and into human behavior is really the story of our father Abraham. Our rabbis tell us, Ele toldos shamayim v'oretz behiborom. These are this generations, the story of heaven and earth when they were created. So our rabbis say that the Hebrew letters that comprise the word behiborom, when they were created, those Hebrew letters spell Avraham. Elu told us Shemaim Oretz be Avraham. In Avraham there is a history of mankind, and that the world, so to speak, came to a position of worth through the efforts of our father Abraham. Avraham Avinu is born in the year 1948 to creation. He's born 400 years after the flood. He's born after Nimrod rules the world, the generation of the Dor HaHafloga, when the world divided into separate peoples and separate nations and scattered all over the face of this globe. Different cultures developed, different civilizations developed. Avraham was witness to all of that. So Avraham lives in a time of tremendous turmoil. I think generally speaking, everyone who lives in a time of tremendous turmoil. The only thing is that there's turmoil and turmoil. But the human life, almost by definition, is dangerous and chaotic and always changing. The only thing constant about life is the fact that it does change. And therefore, this change in life and the changes in civilization always spark reactions. And Avraham Avinu is a reaction to his time, reaction to a thousand years of idolatry. It's a reaction to the destruction of the world by the flood. It's the reaction to the tyranny of Nimrod. It's a reaction to a world not only gone mad, but a world that has no hope for itself until our father Abraham comes forward. He's born in Mesopotamia. We meet him first in the Ur of Chaldees, in the city of Ur in southern Mesopotamia, what is today Iraq, Iran, where the war is going on. And our rabbis, in their own inimitable fashion, ask the question, why didn't the world begin with Avraham? And our rabbis say, you're right, God should have created Avraham first. The only thing is that if Avraham would have messed it up, then nobody would have been able to come and save it. So God saved him. He had a feeling that man would mess it up. Now, in that self-serving, iconoclastic statement, the rabbis here portrayed a vision for us. And the vision is that the world has, so to speak, the world has to be saved from itself. And that there are certain people throughout history who have that ability. and that that ability is perhaps even greater than the ability to build a civilization. The ability to save a civilization is far, far greater achievement. And Avraham Avinu had that quality, so God, so to speak, kept him on reserve. He kept him on ice until he would need him. And that's the story of Avraham. We know the name of Avraham Avinu's mother. The Talmud in Baba Basra mentions it to us, that her name was Amasloi, the daughter of Carnival. That's a good trivia question in Jewish life. In fact, I knew a Jew that in Miami, who any time a rabbi came into town, that was the question he asked him. What was the name of Avraham Avinu's mother? And he asked it to some of the greatest sages of Israel who didn't know it, you know, and that was terribly embarrassing. And he used to say, you know, look at those rabbis, they didn't even know the name of Avraham Avinu's mother. It was the only thing in the Talmud that he knew, by the way. But that did not stop him from being able to make his point. So Avraham Avinu's mother was Amasloi, the daughter of Carnival. And Avraham is the son of Terach, so we know his genealogy. And as I mentioned to you, he's born in the year 1948, the creation. Our rabbis describe him as being a figure, a physical figure of importance, a man that was very tall, a man that was very strong, a man that did not show age. A man that of a very, very robust and vigorous physical characteristics. Rabbis tell us that even Og Melech HaBoshan, the great Og, the giant, who existed at this time and who had a great deal to do with Avraham, there's a medrash that says that Eliezer was a descendant of Og. Eliezer, the servant of Avraham, was a descendant of Og. Others say that Eliezer was a descendant of Nimrod. But it's ironic in any event that the servant of Avraham should be a descendant of those people who in the world are attempting to destroy him. But that happens oftentimes in history, and in Jewish history oftentimes, and oftentimes amongst Jews themselves, that Jews of certain persuasion, their children go off and are of another persuasion, and back and forth. In any event, Avraham Avinu was a very tall and strong and powerful person, and even Og was afraid to start up with him physically, one-on-one. And that's important for us because we always imagine Avraham, we imagine all of our great men as being slightly wimpy. So Avraham's a nice guy. He's a good guy. So I mean, imagine, a nice 5 foot old Jew. So you got to be nice, right? I mean, if God has given you a certain physique and placed you in a certain situation, so then the requirements for being nice are much more inherent within you than if you're 7 foot tall and you're large and no one wants to start up with you. Avraham Avinu is 7 foot tall. I mean, whether those are his exact measurements or not makes no difference. But Avraham Avinu, the Medrash wants us to see him as a very powerful person. Powerful physically. And Avraham Avinu, until the age of 52, had a varied career in life. And we see here also that the Chumash doesn't tell us the biography of the person in terms of his years. The same thing, our teacher Moses, we know nothing about him from the age of 20 about till the age of 80. Those 60 years, which are the bulk of his lifetime, and we would say the bulk of his productive lifetime, are shrouded in mystery. And the Medrash tells us he ran away to Africa, and he became an emperor among the Ethiopians, and he conducted wars, and he was a lawgiver, and He earned degrees, he was an honorary scholar. All of that is not even mentioned in the Chumash. There's no allusion to it because it's not important to the story that the Chumash wants to tell, which is the ultimate mission of Moshe Rabbeinu, which begins at the age of 80 when he returns to Egypt and he becomes the emissary to Paro to free the Jewish people and then to give them the Torah and be the ultimate teacher of the world. So the same thing with Moshe is the same thing with Avraham. Something Avraham lives 52 years. In those 52 years, somehow he acquires the rational understanding and belief in God and in one God. And he is able, through the force of his personality and belief, to have communication with that Creator. And he is chosen for a particular task of founding a unique people, a family in the world that will be different than everyone else. And for that he is persecuted, he is taken and thrown into the cauldron of fire by Nimrod. He undergoes all sorts of privation, he has difficulties with his family. His father was a merchant who sold idols. He was in the, idols was a big business then, just as it is today. Except today it comes with cylinders and tires or whatever, but it was the same type of business. You got a big one, a small one, it matched, you know, color coordinated, whatever you want. Matched your mood, matched your temperament, matched your personality. I have a great story that Rabbi Chaim Zimmerman always used to tell. That the Medrash tells us, you know, that Terach one day left Avram in the shop to take care of the shop with the idols, and Avram took a hammer and smashed all of the idols to bits, and he left one idol with the hammer in the hand of that idol, and when his father came back and said to him, what happened there? So he said, well, he said, you know, they got in a fight and the big one knocked off all the other ones. Which the Medrash uses as the point of illustration of ridicule. So Rabbi Zimmerman said, well, what did Terach answer? What was Terach's response? The Medrash doesn't tell us that. So he said that Terach's response was, he says, listen, Avram, you're a young man yet. You don't understand the world. He says every idol is $50 a week. And so it's a description of the times. The primitive people believed in paganism. They were frightened of it. They were terrorized by it. But the more sophisticated people knew it was nothing. But there was no other choice. There was nothing in the world. They were not on a level of understanding or sophistication to go beyond it. And we'll find that it's happened a number of times in human history. The Greeks and the Romans, for instance, who were pagans, and paganism was the state religion, etc. But the philosophers and the highly educated class, they didn't believe in it. It was their way of life, but they didn't believe in it. If you read Plato, if you read Aristotle, they are not pagans. They just don't know how to formulate it. So they speak in terms of first cause or ultimate creation, all of the philosophical terms which the Greeks introduced to the world to try and raise the people from the morass of idolatry. But that had happened many times before, that there were conscious efforts by society to raise itself from idolatry. But basically those efforts were not successful because they did not lead to an alternative and they did not have the necessary leadership. Avraham Avinu somehow provided that leadership. Avraham Avinu traveled a number of times from Mesopotamia to what would be the land of Israel before his final journey there at the age of 75. But according to the Midrashim, he traveled there a number of times. He was not alone. It was a time of great movement. The new empire arose, the Hittite Empire, and then the Canaanite Empire in Eretz Yisrael itself. It says, Vakrani Oz Boretz. That was a new invasion of peoples. And the Semites were pushed out. They were pushed out of roles of prominence in the government, and then their peoples, literally their tribes, were driven from the country. And the Canaanites were from the tribe of Chum, different ethnic group, perhaps even a different racial stock. And the Greeks from Crete began to move into the country. They came by ship, and they settled along the coast, and they were the forerunners of the Philistines. And they had their kingdom along the coast, especially today what is called the Gaza Strip. And that the Philistines came from the Peloponnesian Islands. They came from Crete, from Cyprus, from Greece. And they settled there with their deities and their culture and their way of life. The Phoenicians were in the north, who were a Canaanite people, and very powerful, opened up trade and merchant marine to all parts of the Mediterranean, were highly skilled in commerce, and began to develop light industry. And then you had nomadic tribes of shepherds, Bedouins, that were in the middle of the country, that wandered from place to place. And soon great towns and cities sprung up. We know by this time Damascus was already a full-blown major city. Damascus is the oldest city known to the civilization. It's over 4,000 years old. It looks it, smells it. And Jerusalem was founded then. But first it was called Salem, Shalem, like in North Carolina. And that Jerusalem was the home of Shem, the son of Noah. That's the area that he settled in, and that's where the Semites gathered. According to the rabbis, Shem and his grandson Aver had an academy of learning. And that academy of learning was devoted to monotheism and was devoted to the traditions of the Creator and morality. But it did not have a large following, it did not have a great attendance, and it was an ivory tower type of school, to the extent that it really did not influence society, but it was there. And in the 400 to 500 years that it existed, great men attended. And it was the basic place of education. Our rabbis say Avraham Avinu attended there. He was part of the student body. He knew Shem. He studied under him. Later he would meet him, Malkitzedek Melech Sholem, when he comes back from the war against the kings. His grandson Yaakov would study there. It was the molding place. It was the place where the knowledge and the philosophy of monotheism was developed. But you had to come there. It didn't come to you. And most people didn't come there. It had a small and select student body, such as Shari Torah. And its influence, therefore, was limited. It was limited to those who wanted to come there. When Avraham was saved from the fire at Ur Kasdim, by the miraculous intervention of God. So Avraham Avinu already had a reputation, but his reputation was that he was someone that was saved from the fire. But that reputation was enough to give him entree into the world. Lindbergh flew the Atlantic, so therefore people wanted to hear Lindbergh lecture, or people wanted to meet Lindbergh, or they wanted their autograph, his autograph. Well, the same thing is true. Here's a man that, you know, was burned alive and he survived. And he stood up to Nimrod, and Nimrod was forced to free him. According to the Medrash, Avraham Avinu was in prison 10 years before Nimrod burned him. If we don't read the Midrashim, we wouldn't know that. We don't know that Avraham Avinu was in prison, incarcerated for that longer period of time. But Avraham Avinu is sacrificed to the ultimate. Literally to the ultimate for the idea, for the cause of monotheism, for the cause of morality. So people came to see him. They came to hear what he had to say. They came to get his autograph. And Avraham Avinu hit upon the original scheme for disseminating ideas in the world. And that was that every place that he went, He opened an inn, a free meal, which has an attraction beyond anything else in life. Witness a Kiddush in Muncie, right? It can be a hurricane outside, a blizzard, but if you're invited to a Kiddush, there's no limit to the lengths that you'll go to have it. Chazal don't mock it. Chazal say, Gedola Lagima. Great is the power of eating and drinking together, of that socializing. Shemekareves Rechokim. It brings together people who are far away. You tell them, you know, come to Shul on Shabbos. It's cold. It's snowy. I can't come, right? I'm making a Kiddush, you know. I have a simcha. I have a Kiddush. Come to the... He's got to come to the Kiddush, right? How can he say no? How can he not come to the Kiddush? That's what the rabbis meant. Shemekareves Rechokim. It brings people from afar. It brings them. So Avraham Avinu hit on that patent. He had a free smorgasbord open at all times. Avraham Avinu was nice to people. He also had a school. Wherever he settled, he made a school. Education. So he had education and he had social welfare. We have to put it in our terms, how we would understand it. He made when he established institutions. And because through those institutions, he was able to reach hundreds and eventually thousands and thousands of people. And then he established what essentially were houses of prayer, houses of meditation, houses where people felt that they could commune with Rabboni Shalom, so to speak, where they could pour out their troubles. It would serve as a place of catharsis for them. It would serve as a place of hope for them. It would give them an attachment, which is something that everyone needs. It was a place of mental health, we could say, emotional health, emotional stability. And Avraham Avinu was the great psychiatrist, and he was the great educator, and he was the great chef. Our rabbis tell us that from the description that we have when the three angels who appeared to him as Bedouins came, so he served each one a tongue with mustard. Each one had his own tongue. And she baked fresh challah. And when you came, people talked for a week afterwards. You know, I was by our, you know what he had? You know what he served on Tuesday? You know what he had there on Wednesday? What a caterer. What a chef. Meanwhile, they spoke about Avraham Avinu. Meanwhile, he had the key to them. So when they came to say thank you, he would say, you know, you don't just have to thank me. You have to thank the one who gave us everything. And that's how people began to expand their horizons. They began to become more sophisticated. They began to realize what the world was. And that was the strength of Avraham Avinu, of his character, of his personality. The Rabboni Shalom also made him a wealthy man because it took great wealth to be able to support this. We all have great ideas. Not always are we able to execute them. And I have great ideas what to do for schools, for institutions, etc., right? But I am hampered by the fact that I don't have the wherewithal to support my ideas. Other people have greater ideas, and they can't do it either. Avraham Avinu had the good fortune that he was probably the first and only Rosh Yeshiva that didn't have to collect money. He didn't have to ask anybody else. He could finance it himself. But how did he earn that money? He earned it also bitterly. And he became a wealthy man through paro, through experiences that essentially were negative, but God protected him and turned them into positive ideas. So our rabbis tell us that Avraham Avinu, when he was 70 years old, on a visit to the land of Israel, had the great vision which we call the Bris Bein Hapsorim, the covenant that singled him and his family out for a special existence in humanity, in the world. And that's really the beginning of the Jewish story. And it is very important to us because Jewish history cannot be understood, in my opinion, under any other guise except through the covenantal theory. That there's a special covenant with the Jewish people. And that covenant holds us and binds us, and it also holds and binds Kaviyachol God also. And that covenant is the single thread which lasts throughout all history. And therefore, whatever happens to the Jewish people is a result of that covenant. And all of the ups and downs that we have had, and there have been unfortunately perhaps more downs than ups, are based upon the predictions of the covenant. And Avraham Avinu, at the age of 70, has that dream. And in the dream, as the Chumash portrays it, he is terror-stricken by the dream. He sees a dream of darkness and of vultures and of fire. He sees Auschwitz. I don't know if you read that article in today's paper on this Nazi Schwammerman that they found in Argentina. Schwammerberger. I mean, it's unspeakable. Take children and smash their heads in and throw them in the fire alive. Well, what kind of a beast do you have to be? Keep dogs that rip people apart alive. And he's sitting there in Argentina 40 years, are they, you know, nothing. Oh, that Schwammerberger, that's the one you wanted. We didn't know that. Avraham Avinu sees that in his dream. He sees the enslavement of Egypt. He sees the destructions that will come upon the Jewish people and upon civilization generally, and he is terror-stricken by it. And God appears to him and gives him the charge, gives him the choice. Do you want to be or not to be? Really up to him. And once he accepts the challenge, then history progresses. And in reality, that is the challenge that faces each and every Jew, and certainly each and every Jewish generation. You want to keep it going, you can stop. The only thing is that now the covenant is so old, and we've been through so much, and there's such a momentum to it that I don't think that we could stop even if we wanted to stop. There are too many forces that have been loosed that forced the covenant to continue. But Avraham Avinu could have ended it. That great covenant, the Bris Bein Apsorim, remains till today. That's the foundation stone of human history and certainly of Jewish history. That's how Jewish history has to be seen. So if we see now the struggles that exist within the Jewish people and the struggles that exist between the Jewish people and the rest of the world, the struggle is the struggle of the covenant. To observe the covenant, to live by it, to pursue its goals, to give up on the covenant, to forget about it, to turn our backs on it. The struggle of the world to break the covenant from us, to take it away from us. Right? What do the cardinals say there? That Christianity is the fulfillment of Judaism. No, the covenant is over. That's the struggle that exists today. And that's exactly how the Chumash wanted us to see it, and that's exactly how the rabbis portrayed it. Avraham Avinu has a very difficult family life as well. He's married to Sarah, who was a great woman in her own, not only as the wife of Abraham, that's one of her titles, but Sarah, as in her own right, is a great woman. Sarah, without Abraham, would have been a tremendous force to reckon with in the world. And her influence is felt. It's felt to such an extent that the Chumash tells us that our father Abraham was told, listen to Sarah. Kol asher tomar elecha Sarah shma bekola. What Sarah says, listen. Our rabbis say she was greater in prophecy than Abraham was. She had the gift of greatness, of great intuition, of great knowledge. And yet they had a long and difficult life together. Hard problems, one after another. Avraham Avinu is forced to travel to Egypt. There's a hunger in the land. He goes down to Egypt. It's interesting that in Egypt, all ancient historians say that there were a number of the pharaohs that basically were monotheists. Amenhotep and others who were basically monotheists. All of those pharaohs lived during or directly after the time of Abraham. His visit to Egypt made an impression. It made an impression upon Egyptian society and upon pharaohs. So that even in the highest forms of, highest echelons of Egyptian society, the idea of monotheism took hold. But they had no way to sell it to the masses, number one. And number two, it's a little like our friend Gorbachev. You got such a bureaucracy, you can't change it. Whether it's true or not, whether they believe it or not, all the people that worked in the temples, all the priests of the idols, I mean, that was a bureaucracy. And you had to deal with it. They were not going to give it up. And that's a real force. That's not, you know, that's not something to be mocked at and said, oh, you know, well, so what? That's a very real force. People fight for their privileges, for their job. You can't just eliminate them. They won't let it happen. And the greatest of administrators and the greatest of idea men sometime come on top and they are ready and they are undone by the clerks. They're undone by the people, literally by the administration. John Kennedy once said that dealing with the State Department, he said, is like trying to grab hold of an amorphous mass. He said, it's not for nothing that the State Department's building is located in a place called Foggy Bottom. You can't get hold of it. You set foreign policy, but the guy that's on the lower echelon that has to deliver the message, he's not interested in your foreign policy. He's interested in his foreign policy. And he does what he wants to do. And to grab one of the great and most difficult tasks of any administrator is to get the workers to do his will, his bidding. It's an enormous task. And that's what happened with Egyptian society. Egyptian society remained pagan because the infrastructure of paganism was so strong that the pharaoh himself couldn't turn it around. The pharaoh himself was a monotheist and wanted monotheism, but he had 50,000 guys working as pagans. So whether they believed it or not, they were not going to give up their jobs. It's interesting that the Catholic Church, the Christian Church in its early form, when it came into being, overcame the problem by incorporating within themselves all the pagan priests. They sprinkled them with water and they made them priests. Right? So they gave them another job. So the change of administration was like civil service. With the change of administration, they didn't lose their job. Well, that ameliorated to a great extent the difficulties that made the transition much easier. So Avraham Avinu had a profound influence on the Egyptian society, but the Egyptian society basically did not change, just as it did not change at the time of Joseph, who was in a command position and who tried to break the power of the clergy and was unable to, as we'll see later in one of our lectures. Avraham Avinu therefore suffers, Paro takes Sora away from him, he has to get her back. Sora is a barren woman, they don't have children, that's the bane of their existence. They try different methods, today we would say fertility methods. Avraham marries Hagar in order that in the house there should be a child, and perhaps they will be, she, as Sora said, I will be built from her. Because of the fact that it's one of the strange things that exists, but it's medically proven that, for instance, people who don't have children and adopt a child, so then almost 30% of them then later on conceive and have children. The presence of the child in the house somehow affects the ability to conceive. That's what Sora wanted with Hagar. But Hagar was a difficult person. Hagar was a princess by herself. Hagar took advantage of the situation. Poor Sarah felt neglected. Hagar also has a child, Yishmael, who is not quite what the doctor ordered. So the domestic turbulence of the house is omnipresent. Avraham Avinu has a nephew, Lot, whom he hopes to train as his heir apparent. And Lot, once tasting the taste of success, decides that Efshi be Avraham uvelokov. I don't want Avraham. I don't want his God. I don't want the responsibility. I want the covenant. Leave me alone. There's a great poem by a famous American poet. I forget his name now. Jewish poet. First name is Howard. I don't know what his second name. I forgot.
Nemiroff.
Exactly. Thank you, Dr. Weiss. Howard Nemiroff has a great poem on Lot. And the thrust of the poem is that Lot says, you know, I know that you have great things to do, God, and I know it's all important, but he said, just leave me alone. I just want to sit on the patio and with my children and just, you know, let me out. I don't want to be part of history. Which is a very good insight into Lot as Chazal saw it also. Lot is not an evil person. He just doesn't want to shoulder the burdens of the covenant. He takes a look at his uncle and he says, God, you know, the guy's got to get up so early in the morning, he's working till late at night, and he never has a day off, and everybody comes and bother him. I'm like, what? Who needs it? And Sdom is the perfect place, as our rabbis portrayed it, for a person to escape responsibility. In Sdom, they don't allow beggars, they don't allow social responsibility, you don't have to worry about anybody else, nobody can bother you. I always think of that when I travel to Miami Beach. So a number of my clients live on islands. There are islands in the, off of the beach, off of the causeways. And to get into the island, you got to drive by a guard, and you have to identify yourself, and he calls in, and he looks through the car, and he wants to know what you are. And it's just, you know, like some in my mind's eye, I have a picture of an amphibious invasion of that island by Meshulochim from the land of Israel, who would land on the beaches and, you know, break down the defenses of the island. But that was Sdom. Sdom was that kind of an island. It was protected against all outside problems. And because it was so insulated, and it was Grosse Pointe, Michigan, or wherever, Scarsdale, or wherever else you want to, however else you want to identify it, where never is heard a discouraging word and the skies are not cloudy all day. That's where Lot escapes to. And poor Avram is shattered by it. Because Avram's commitment now is to the covenant. Avram's commitment now is to build civilization through himself and his family. That's his commitment. And here his family forsakes him. Until Avram realizes that the only way that it will happen is through his own child. If he will have a blood child, if he'll have a lineal descent, someone that is flesh of his flesh and blood of his blood. And that is only the solution to the problem. The only problem is that his wife is incapable of having children. She's infertile. And our rabbis portrayed that as always the state of the Jewish people. That's part of the idea of the covenant, is that there cannot be a future. If you'll sit down on paper and figure it out, there cannot be a future. The Jewish people are always infertile. There cannot be another generation. It can't be that Sarah is going to give birth. How can such a thing be? And the world, in fact, counts upon it. It's a sure thing that it's going to disappear. And it's interesting that even though we've been around for 4,000 years, and the world does not lose its patience, they're still waiting for it to happen. Yeah. And it's an interesting thing that among Jews, almost the same attitude pertains towards Torah and towards religious Jews, right? Let's just wait a while. It's, you know, somehow, you know, all these guys are going to disappear. Can't be that in the 20th century, I remember when I went to law school, my Jewish friends in law school used to tell me, it can't be in the 20th century that you're still eating kosher. Like in the 20th century something happened that made it so superior to the 6th century. So I used to always answer them. I had a big mouth then because I was going to be a lawyer. So I always answered them, you know, it can't be that in the 20th century they're going to kill 6 million people. A lot of things can be. But the future of the Jewish people is always that there is no future. That's the given. That's the given of the covenant. You start to make the reckoning on paper, it will never add up. Right? I always say that regarding the yeshiva budget, and I'm right, it never does add up. But the place is here. The Jewish people are here. The state of Israel has no economy, and it has indefensible borders, and it's surrounded by enemies, and it's opposed by most of the world. So there's no future. It has no future whatsoever. But I think it does have a future, because it's the Jewish state, the Jewish people. The Jewish people have a tremendous future, except one doesn't see it in the same plane, in the same level of understanding that makes everything else logical. And that's what the Torah tells us. Mimi le'ele Avraham heiniko bonim Sora. Who could have imagined that Avraham should have a child, that Sarah should nurse a child at her bosom? Who could imagine such a thing? That's the world's wonderment. Wonderment that Jewish people are still here. I mean, there's a state of Israel, there's Torah, there's Yeshiva. I mean, how can that be? That's the covenantal nature of Jewish history. Avraham Avinu engages in education and in goodness and morality in a world that is constantly at war. In the Chumash, we read about a war that lasted 26 years, that involved 9 of the great kings of the area. That's a long war. You know, like it's almost in the European wars, with the 100-year war, France and England, the 30-year war, and the Protestant Reformation. Those are long wars. Well, we now have shorter wars because we're much more efficient. We're able to take care of many more people in a shorter period of time. But that's not true. There is the Iran-Iraq war is 8 years already. And if we'll leave them alone, they can do it for the next 100 years. They're not going to get tired of it. And there are other struggles that are a very long duration. So here a major part of Avraham Avinu's lifetime is occupied by this great war. And he attempts to remain neutral, because as the Jewish feeling regarding most wars was until the Second World War, when we were unfortunately the victims, but most of the time we really didn't care who won the war, because it was not our war and we were going to be the loser whoever won. And therefore it was not our concern. And that's Avraham Avinu's attitude. Until Lot is captured, and he heard that through Og that his nephew Lot was captured, and he heard that the city of Sodom was sacked, and he runs to save his nephew. And that's how he becomes involved in the war. So he becomes a world hero. He ends the war. He defeats the kings. He brings peace to the area. In his time, they didn't have a Nobel Prize. But I'm certain that he would have been nominated at least for the Nobel Peace Prize. Avraham Avinu would have made it. But it doesn't have a lasting effect on humanity, because the tensions and the greed and the violence is just subdued for a moment, but it doesn't really go away. And Avraham Avinu is out to pursue the idea of improving civilization. The Meiri says in one of his great comments in his introduction to the book of Ovos, so the Meiri gives, if you have a chance to read that introduction in the Beis HaBchira, it is well worth your while. Unfortunately, I don't know of a good translation in English. But it's an enormously great work on Jewish history in which the Meiri traces really world history from Adam until his day. He shows you generation, and he traces back his genealogy to Adam. And he mentions there that he has by a tradition from his rabbis, from his teachers, from his family, that Avraham Avinu reached half of civilization. 50% of the world he was able to reach through his methods, through his education, through his inns, through his culture, so that half the world came to a greater appreciation of themselves and of God and were able to rouse themselves from the slumber of paganism. That's an enormous, enormous achievement, one that it lays the bedrock for everything else that's going to come in human civilization, because now there is an echo within so many thousands of families that there is religion, that there's God, that there's morality, that there's a higher order, that there's a greater purpose to life. And it's on that bedrock that all advances in human civilization have come, on the foundation that Avraham Avinu himself laid. When Avraham finally is blessed with Yitzchak, so we know the great story of the Akedah, that even that is always in jeopardy. I mean, that's what the story comes to show us, that even when all the miracles occur and when we finally have what we're supposed to have and God grants us our future and we're willing to undertake the covenantal journey, it still is in danger. It's only a hair's breadth, only the voice of the angel which says, don't stretch forth your hand to slay the child. Only that voice, that breath, is the difference between survival and between extinction. That also is a lesson for all of history. Our rabbis tell us that Avraham Avinu Maase Ovo Simon Labonim, the life of our father Abraham, is meant to be an exemplary blueprint of the story of the Jewish people. So in that respect, it is the story where we have no future, and then when we do have the future, it's always in danger. It's always meant to be taken away from us. I always mention that regarding the state of Israel again. Well, the state of Israel has fought 5 wars in 40 years. One would think, you know, we finally achieved it after 1900 years, so let us alone for a while. Give us 100 years off, right? Not a bad idea. The guys in yeshiva always tell me, you know, Rebbe, give us a week off, right? Don't say shir this week, right? Don't teach. Let's catch our breath. We had a very hard piece of Gemara to learn, so they finally got it, and they prepared it, and they have it, and they're proud of themselves, so let's have a day off. You mean we're going to learn today? Today we're going to start again? We're going to go ahead? That's the lesson of Avraham Avinu. That's why it says Avraham Avinu was tested 10 times. The pressure is always on, because that's the story of the Jewish people. The story of the Jewish people is that the pressure is always on. And Avraham Avinu has to walk this tightrope. He has to deal, Avimelech steals the wells from him, and he has to come and argue and get them back. When it comes, his wife Sarah dies and he has to come and purchase a grave. So his neighbors, the Hittites, say to him, oh, it's an honor and a pleasure. What are you talking about? The Prince of God himself. Couldn't be better. Imagine that. He comes to put up. So then he's got to pay the full price. He's got to overpay the price. They're not willing to give him anything. Which is, again, an example of the world. They are not deceitful when they say, Nasi Elohim Ato B'Sochenu, you are the Prince of God. That was the reputation Avraham Avinu had in the world. People came to see him. Our rabbis say that people who were ill came to see him. If Avraham Avinu looked at you, you were cured. Our rabbis say that he had a medallion that hung from his neck, the Malamed Zchus, on people that wear chains. He had a medallion, and Avraham Avinu wore a chain. He had a medallion around his neck. And the medallion had curative powers. And you saw Avraham Avinu, and he gave you a blessing, and you saw his medallion, you were cured. So people came to him. Everybody that was in Tzoras came to him. Avraham Avinu was an easy touch. You know, you need $1,000. You know, you got to You got a wedding coming up. You got to make a mortgage payment. Yeah, here, Avraham Avinu had the first Gemilas Chesed was Avraham Avinu. The Medrash says that he had millions lent out. When Avraham Avinu died, it said the whole world wept because the soft touch was gone. He was irreplaceable to everyone. But when it comes, so imagine a man like that, that everybody owes him a favor, and he is such an asset to the community, and he is such a great person, and he's the Prince of God who lives in our midst, and his wife died, and he needs a grave. No, sir. 400 shekel kesef over la socher. That's in a generation, that's at least 40 years wages for a laborer. 400 shekel. 40 years of earning power. That's right, but it was go. No. The over la socher does not modify the grave. It modifies the money that he gave. The money that he gave was in mint condition that any businessman would have accepted that money. Because in the ancient world, money was not the way it is today. It wasn't paper. It wasn't face value. Money had to have an intrinsic value. So he paid, in the words of the Talmud, taklin charetin, new big coins, mint condition. But here he needs something, and the world is not willing to give it to him. There's a great lesson for that too, my friends. You can invent the polio vaccine, and you can be the conductor of the New York Philharmonic, and you can win the Nobel Peace Prize, and you can invent the theory of relativity, and you can make the atom bomb, and you can be the greatest doctor in the world. The day will come, and they'll tell you, listen, you know, it's nice knowing you, right? But we're not going to do anything for you. That's also part of the covenant. And through the life of Avraham, we see that. We see that, unfortunately, so clearly. We're not going to do anything for you. It makes no difference. It makes no difference that half of the German Nobel Prize winners were Jewish. That made no difference. It made no difference whatsoever. And that's a bitter lesson. But that's, again, the lesson of Avraham Avinu. In conclusion, now there's so much that can be said about Avraham Avinu, but in conclusion, we have to understand that also Avraham Avinu, in his lifetime, saw how difficult the situation would be. He was not fooled by it. He did not have illusions. And he understood that in order for him to achieve what he had to achieve, and for his people, his family to be what it had to be, that he had to therefore narrow, so to speak, his scope. He could not be everybody. He had to withdraw. He had to become more intimate. He had to do it on a smaller scale. So even though he is Av Hamon Goyim, he is the father of many nations, and he's the father of the whole world, and his influence is worldwide. He is looking to have a child. He's looking to have a grandchild. A rabbi say that the first 15 years of the life of Yaakov Avinu, he was raised by Yezeda. He was raised by Avraham. The Ish Tam Yoshev Oholim, the man of perfection who dwelt in the tent. So he didn't go to the yeshiva Shem Ve'Aver until he left his father's home. Who raised him? Why did he grow up differently than Esav? So rabbis say because he was raised by Abraham. Abraham invested in him all of his hopes, all of his future. He narrowed his scope because he knew that if he had one Yaakov, then it would continue. The commitment of the Jewish people is such that it has to be a mile deep, even if it's only an inch wide. Unfortunately, many times there are people who are happy to have it a mile wide and an inch deep. And that will not last. Part of the problem of Eastern European Jewry was that they were all religious Jews, they were all Orthodox Jews, but unfortunately the masses had a very narrow commitment, not very deep. So even though it extended to millions of people, but when they came to the United States, or they came to a new society, or the Enlightenment hit them, or secular Zionism hit them, or socialism hit them, or communism hit them, goodbye. But only those that were rooted very, very deeply have always been able to withstand the winds of change and the vicissitudes of life and the problems of society. And that is a basic lesson that we see from Avraham Avinu, that he concentrated, I always mention the United States Marines, right? A few good men. Now, Levi, they should have them. But that's really what the Jewish people are out to have. Avraham Avinu was out to have a few good men. And our rabbis tell us that the fatherhood of Avraham Avinu extends even beyond the grave. Our rabbis in their imagery say that Avraham Avinu sits at the gate of hell, of Gehenim, and if a Jew comes, he doesn't let him go in. He turns down the thermostat for him. Cools it off. Because that, again, is the covenantal nature of Avraham Avinu. And that covenant lasts until today. That covenant lasts until today. And that's what our rabbis mean when they say that the tree that Avraham Avinu planted in Beersheba was the wood by which the Mishkan was built, the Briach HaTichon. The bracing piece of wood that held the Mishkan together was made from the tree that Avraham Avinu built in Beersheba. And our rabbis say that Lasid Lovo, when the Beis HaMikdash is built, so that wood will be there also. And they're not only talking about the piece of wood, they're talking about the idea, the investment of the commitment, the understanding of the covenant, the commitment to the greatness and to the strength and to the future of the Jewish people and to the ideas that Avraham Avinu had. And therefore, Avraham Avinu, when he died and was buried in the Moras HaMachpelah, in the cave of Machpelah, so even in death he became the symbol of life. And his burial place became a holy place for millions of people. And because of the fact of his tremendous influence. It's ironic that the Talmud says that Avraham Avinu, since he paid for it, so he said to himself that when the rest of the world claims that it doesn't belong to the Jewish people, at least here they won't be able to claim it. Because here, I have the deed, we paid for it. But ironically, it hasn't turned out that way yet. Ironically, that place also is in dispute, also part of the covenantal idea. And because of that, that's the covenant of Avraham, which is impressed in our flesh as the sign of the covenant of Avraham Avinu, which is our faith and our belief and is the acceptance of the Torah and of Jewish responsibility and of Jewish history and destiny, all of that combines to give us that impression of that great person who single-handedly changed the course of history and became the father of civilization and the father of the people of Israel.